Hi, I'm David Kleon. I'm senior editor at Blogging Heads TV. This is an episode of Worldwise, and I'm speaking today with Jonathan Kay, who is in Toronto. John, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, John Kay here, managing editor for Comment at the National Post newspaper, which is based in Toronto.
Great. So we're going to talk about a number of things relating to Canadian politics today. But to start with, I just want to say, so I am recording this from my home in New York City. New York City, if you've heard of it up there, is roughly America's equivalent to Toronto. It's our largest city and our kind of financial and cultural center. And
I've heard of it.
you've heard of it. That's good. I'm not sure everyone has, but we have a newly elected mayor here. His name is Bill de Blasio. He, unlike some previous mayors, is not from the sort of downtown Manhattan financial elite, but is from a more outlying area called Brooklyn that was not originally part of the city, but was annexed to it in a relatively middle class area in Brooklyn. He was elected on a wave of populist resentment against the previous mayor, whose name was Michael Bloomberg, who was a wealthy downtown elite who was very fond of bike lanes and such. And so far, de Blasio's tenure has been marked by scandal. For example, he was caught on camera eating pizza with a knife and fork, which is considered very déclassé here. So we're all a little embarrassed. This isn't really behavior befitting of a great world city. And I assume in Toronto you would agree, right? I mean, how is your mayor? I assume he would never embarrass you like that.
It's actually I just as a sidebar, I have no problem with eating pizza with a knife and fork. I do it all the time, and I think I support his position on that. Rob Ford, what can you say about Rob Ford? He's the most famous Canadian we've created since Wayne Gretzky. And he's been disgracing the city, I guess, for a better part of a year now. Stumbling from one episode to another, drunken nightclub incidents. He's admitted to crack cocaine usage. He has a foul mouth. He's used the N-word. He's used the W word to refer to Italian Canadians.
Oh, wow.
He's referred,
Bill de Blasio would never do that, but
any letter in the alphabet. He's used that word. He is now at large. No one quite knows where he is because he's taken some time off for rehab. He said he was going to go to the United States for rehab, but apparently the Americans wouldn't let him in. And so now
because he
he's
uses
in
crack cocaine.
a variety of things. I think there's criminal affiliations might be part of it. So no one knows quite where he is now. However, his infamy continues. If you watch the American late night shows, Jimmy Kimmel in particular has become kind of obsessed with Rob
Well,
Ford.
Jimmy Kimmel interviewed him, right? I mean, he brought him on the show,
He
like
didn't
in the
just
last few
interview him,
months.
though. He's sort of there's been tweets and all kinds of stuff in the media, like sort of a strange obsession with Rob Ford. Although, in fairness, most of Canada now has a strange obsession with Rob Ford. And as you said, this whole thing with Rob Ford did start off in a sort of mainstream political way as a suburban backlash against the previous incumbent, a guy by the name of David Miller, who was very much in the Bloomberg mold. He was literally a Prius-driving Ivy League type. He very blow-dried.
I feel like Michael Bloomberg can do better than a Prius, but yes.
Actually, this I think David Miller, if memory serves, one step better. He had a Prius, but I think he had a chauffeur drive the Prius.
Of course.
So it was, and so in every respect, he was part of the stereotype of the downtown elite, and there was a rebellion against that. And Rob Ford was a part of a protest vote against that. Unfortunately, Rob Ford then went beyond what even his realist critics accused him of being. He was, I don't need to repeat the long list of stuff he's done. And so
Well,
now.
actually, if you could just repeat what last week's developments were, because he doesn't seem to have just randomly had a come to Jesus moment with this rehab thing. It looks like there's another round of embarrassment for him going into that, right?
Okay. Well, the latest one involved him going to a nightclub. I believe the nightclub was called Music with a K at the end. And I think he was there till all hours, 5 a.m. or something like that. Some reports that he threw up in the bathroom after spending the entire night getting drunk. Reports of new drug use. The thing, I mean, 10
wasn't,
years
wasn't
ago...
Wasn't he on a video in his sister's basement smoking crack again or something like that?
Oh, yeah, I didn't even mention that because that's scarcely news.
I thought it was news, sort of, that he is still smoking crack because he had maintained he had only done it the one time, and which I don't think anyone believed, but this is the first
evidence.
That is
news. Yeah. This being Canada, his use of the N-word and the W-word is even more offensive to us.
That's a healthy attitude, I think.
We're fairly libertarian about drug usage. We're not libertarian about
even crack usage?
Yeah, I mean, the crack usage was terrible. And obviously, he sets a terrible example for kids. But the deal was always, you know, that whatever he was doing, that he would retain some semi-functional aspect as Toronto's mayor. But in the last few months, he's become so dysfunctional that essentially the whole city is now being run by the deputy mayor, mm-hmm. because he is not even capable of even nominally performing his mayoral functions. And as I said, no one even quite knows where he is now. So he's become kind of the hobo mayor.
So aside from wherever Rob Ford happens to be at any particular moment, it's not chaos in the streets of Toronto right now. Things are still running smoothly.
It never was chaos in the streets of Toronto. You know, the interesting thing about Toronto is, as infamous as our mayor is, the city actually has a fairly weak mayoral system in the mm-hmm. sense that city councillors have the same vote on city council that the mayor does. The mayor just has one vote. Now, he helped run the executive council and he helped set the agenda for the city. But Toronto was a smoothly running city before Ford was the mayor. It was a smoothly running city while Ford has been the mayor. It will be a smoothly running city after. Everyone in Toronto has complaints about public transit and garbage collection and all the usual sure. things that I'm sure people in Brooklyn complain about.
I'm in Harlem, by the way. All my friends are in Brooklyn, so yes.
Okay. Yeah, so if you're in Park Slope, I'm sure you spend a good deal of time bitching about things like, you know, garbage collection and recyclables and stuff like that. And we do that too.
I think they mostly bitch about whether their food is organic or not. I think that's the big obsession there. But
yeah.
Sorry, I digress. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I'll segue from that saying, you know, Rob Ford was very much a fast food populist, mm-hmm. and probably the rebellion against him will elect some gluten-free, organic-eating, blow-dried urban type, and the cycle will continue. And
well,
the next election, yeah.
Well, so I Go saw ahead. That I saw that in going to rehab, he's suspending his campaign activities, a la John McCain in 08. But I saw a poll. He is still not completely unviable. He has what, like a third or so of the city that would still vote for him. I assume no matter what at this point.
It's not a third. I'd say it's probably closer to 20 or 25%. I actually just yesterday ran into a guy at my health club who was just going on this tedious rant about how he would vote for Ford no matter what, because, and then he said something unintelligible about the city's elites and whatnot. And there is a constituency for that. My view has always been that his best hope is what I call the Oprah vote, which is the comeback kid who beats drug addiction, who beats booze addiction by going to rehab, by coming back 40 pounds lighter, by telling everybody about how he's cured. It wouldn't hurt his chances if he became an evangelical Christian. I think that would be a good campaign move. But he's got to show that he's a changed man.
Yeah.
You know, a guy who stumbles around puking all over nightclubs is probably a little much, even for the populists who were inclined to vote for him the first time.
You know, I'll tell you that for all we snark this here, and I guess this what I'm about to say gets snarked a lot too here. You know, so I'm in New York now, and it is almost impossible to imagine this happening in New York. The de Blasio example I mentioned earlier, of course, is an example of kind of left of center populism led by the city's kind of middle to upper middle class educated types against the super wealthy who dominate Manhattan, because, you know, and with the support of a broad cross section of poorer and more working class New Yorkers. You know, and de Blasio has had some stumbles, but he's a dignified and smart man, and he has some good policies. I like his housing policies so far. It's very hard to imagine that kind of thing happening in New York. That said, until August, I had lived for the last 4 years, and I also grew up in and around Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C. actually has some analogy to the Ford situation. It is much more racially tinged there. But in Washington, D.C., which is now, I think, a bare plurality black, but for most of the last half century was a large majority black city with a kind of wealthy or upper middle class white minority that, you know, was more plugged into the federal government, but was mostly a poor working or lower middle class city. We Washington, I guess, two separate times interrupted by a jail term for crack, elected our mayor, Marion Barry, who is actually still on the city council. He represents Ward 8, which is the poorest and blackest eighth of Washington, D.C., where he's a popular folk hero. And I should say, Marion Barry is a very smart man. He's a brilliant politician. He was in his 80s prime, not a wholly terrible mayor. I mean, people will dispute that endlessly, but it's the crack and related scandals that brought him down. When he was reelected in the 90s, after leaving jail, the Republican Congress basically stripped him of all real power. So although Toronto actually is allowed to govern itself, unlike D.C., which is the D.C. situation is kind of an obscenity, you know, there is, I guess, some analogy in that he was basically a powerless figurehead mayor for those years. And his, you know, the reason he keeps getting elected even today is because, as a kind of FU to a certain type of Washingtonian, and not just that, a sense of kind of, you know, he represents a certain swath of the city, and he speaks to them, and he understands them and what they've been through. So, sorry, that was a long digression, but I assume that analogy resonates.
There's a couple of themes there that certainly do resonate. One is the idea that there's a lot of voters in Canada and the United States who don't think much of municipal politics. Mm-hmm. And because they think the stakes are low, they think, oh, this is a great opportunity for me to simply vote with my gut to the extent I vote at all, because turnout tends to be low. That they're just going to vote, as you say, as a protest vote, or they're going to vote along tribal lines, you know, whether it's political tribe or regional tribe. Or racial tribe.
Yeah, although
the idea is that
I would problematize that a bit with Barry, that people are engaged, and Barry has always taken care of his community, you know, in terms of giving out jobs and contracts and things like that. He's very good at what I guess you call retail politics, which I gather Ford is too, right?
Ford is fantastic at retail politics.
Yeah.
Gives out a cell phone number. You know, people who have had contact with him, everyone wants to get their picture taken with the guy. The other thing is party politics. Mm-hmm. Toronto municipal politics, there's no party system. And people love to bitch about party politics, Republican Party politics, Democratic Party politics here in Canada, Liberal, Conservative, NDP Party politics. But party politics impose a certain discipline on the selection of candidates. The reason no one like Rob Ford would ever become provincial premier or prime minister or, in the United States, president or state governor, although you had someone, you know, you had Jesse Ventura in Minnesota, But
he's
the reason that
generous,
happens,
as is Minnesota, but
yeah, it's quite right. But the reason it doesn't happen is because party politics imposes a rigorous discipline on people through the disclosure process that comes with nomination, mm-hmm. and with raising money. You can't raise money if you're a guy who pukes in nightclubs. And so we love to complain about the party politics system, but party politics imposes discipline on the selection of candidates. And in City of Toronto, and I think this is true also of Washington, D.C., is that you don't necessarily have to run in a primary. You don't have to be selected by a party machinery before you win an election as ward councillor or mayor. And as a result, you can get some weirdo hotheads, or in Toronto you can get a drug addict, who just get elected directly by voters. So it's something – it's a cautionary tale, but people say, oh, let's just get rid of the party system when it comes to regional or national politics – that comes with a price. The price is you get rid of the vetting function that comes with party apparatus.
Right. Well, D.C.'s Republican Party is so small as to be almost meaningless. But there are some seats reserved on the city council for independents, which does bring some a minority of citywide politicians who are not part of the Democratic vetting process. But anyway, that's enough about D.C. One last thing about Rob Ford before we take this segue you've provided and talk about national Canadian politics. How does Toronto as a whole, I guess, feel about what you said earlier about Rob Ford being the most famous Canadian since Wayne Gretzky. How do you, although I feel like Justin Bieber, who I know recently had a bad encounter with the mayor, might take issue with that. But how do both his supporters and people such as yourself, who I think are embarrassed by him, what do you make of sort of Rob Ford international phenomenon, and in particular Rob Ford American phenomenon? Has Rob Ford in your mind changed the stereotypical American view of Toronto and of Canada?
I think 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, we kind of would have been thrilled by it because the attitude would have been like, oh, look, the United States is paying attention to us. This maybe people will look at the Wikipedia entry for Canada and learn more about our RCMP and stuff like that. We were so starved for attention from the Americans for so long that any attention was something we desired. And I think that's changed over the last decade or so as Canada has become more prominent on the world stage. Here in Toronto, we get like tons of visitors from the eastern United States to see the Raptors or to see the Maple Leafs or
great indie rock scene you guys have.
Indie rock scene. We have this world-class film festival that makes downtown uninhabitable for 2 weeks. So the last decade or so, Toronto has gotten almost too big. And as a result, people in Toronto, they've kind of gotten blasé about international attention to the extent that when it's unwelcome, as in the case of Rob Ford, it's just an annoyance. Mm-hmm. And I think Torontonians, no disrespect to Jimmy Kimmel, they'd love for the whole thing to be gone.
Right.
And a lot of them would like to just have some boring, generic mayor. And we wouldn't have to deal with, like right now, I mean, it really isn't. I mean, you can go anywhere in the world now and mention you're from Toronto. And the first thing that'll come out of their mouth, whether it's in Tokyo or Washington or LA or wherever, everybody knows Rob Ford. And
judging from Marion Barry, if he's any precedent, I think you've got another 20-30 years in counting of this. I mean, granted, Barry's still in the picture in some form, but it never goes away. You'll tell people you're from DC, they'll crack about Marion Barry. I mean, DC's had a remarkable turnaround in terms of its dropping crime and rise in wealth and is probably the liveliest it's ever been. It doesn't matter. We'll always be Marion Barry's town.
Yeah. The special problem with Rob Ford in this regard is that the guy really does look like a joke. Like he looks like a character from a Mike Myers movie or something like that. And he
looks
so
like Chris Farley, the late Chris Farley.
But, he does. Yeah. And his lifestyle is not too dissimilar.
No.
But he's so physically iconic. I mean, they've even made bobblehead dolls of him here in Toronto. That, as you say, it will be many, many years till people from Toronto stop getting that as the first reference that gets dropped when they mention to someone from Dubai Toronto's my hometown.
Well, and it's important to have a good sense of humor about it, although, unfortunately, I mean, occasionally I have to sort of check myself. Occasionally I see John Stewart will check himself and the truth is it's not that funny. It's addiction. And there's also an undercurrent of domestic abuse to the whole thing, which rarely gets talked about.
No, the whole thing is a train wreck. I mean, his sister and his wife, the whole family has these horrible dysfunctionalities swirling around them. To live within the family must be a horrible, miserable experience. But
despite their immense fortune, right? They do have a lot of money, right?
They are wealthy, but it's that doesn't buy happiness.
No,
there's all kinds of other issues going on.
Ask Justin Bieber.
It's a cautionary tale that goes to the fact that when you look very closely at these lives, they're very sad and tragic. But of course, when you look at them from 5,000 miles away, you're in some studio in L.A., it becomes a big joke.
Right.
And that's the way the human condition is. Up close, it can be very sad, but far away, you can just it's funny.
Which is so weird because there are hundreds of these stories in L.A. I mean, of high profile versions of these stories in L.A. I mean, if anyone knows about self-destructive, wealthy, in the spotlight people, it's Los Angelinos, but
I guess they'd be more empathetic.
I would not think that, but
maybe not.
But yeah. All right. Well, anyway, I guess we may as well transition away from Rob Ford now. But there is a sort of a link here, in that Rob Ford is a conservative politician. He was elected as part of this conservative backlash in Toronto, which, as you've discussed in previous Blogging Heads episodes, was brought about when, I guess, 1998, when the kind of liberal inner core city of Toronto consolidated with the vast surrounding conservative suburbs. So, I mean, beyond his singular vulgarity and crack addiction and so on, Rob Ford is also surprising, I think, to a lot of Americans, because how did Canada's big cosmopolitan indie rock, you know, film festival city elect this conservative populist mayor? And this also highlights the fact that Americans pay so little. I mean, maybe, you know, political junkies in D.C., but Americans as a whole pay so little attention to Canadian politics, they may not be aware that for the past decade, Canada has had a quite conservative prime minister, and that there is a deep conservative streak in Canada. And this, as far as I can tell from following it on and off, comes from a combination of factors. One is that Stephen Harper, the prime minister in question, is a very talented politician. One is that the liberal opposition seems to be in disarray. And one is that I think there is a large, authentic, silent, possibly majority, silent plurality of Canadians who are actually quite conservative. So what's your take on the Harper phenomenon? How has he stayed in power for so long? And what is the nature of Canadian conservatism?
I don't want to overstate how conservative Canada has become. You know, it's important to remember that at the end of the day, regardless of the postures that Harper puts on, you know, Canada is still a welfare state, fairly generous welfare benefits by American standards. We have universal health care. You know, this is the continues to be the main domestic issue of division in the United States, and we have, you know, a turbocharged version of Obamacare. And that's not something that
sounds,
Harper has
sounds great to me, by the way.
Well, yeah, you're an urban elite.
I sure am.
I'm
urban anyway, but yeah.
Oh, and we have gay marriage coast to coast. You know, there's no Alabama in the United States. You know, we have gay marriage from Vancouver all the way to Halifax. You can get gay married anywhere. And that's not something Harper has challenged. What he has challenged is our foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Canada used to, you know, Pierre Trudeau, prime minister back in the 70s, he was, you know, best pals with Fidel Castro. He loves sticking his finger in Uncle Sam's eye, and for decades that was basically what our foreign policy was. We were going to be the multilateral yin to America's yang.
Right.
And what really changed that was 9/11, because that was sort of a put up or shut up time for Canada. We sent troops to Afghanistan. Our troops were there for, you know, their mission, I think, just ended a few months ago. And that created a wave of military patriotism in Canada, something we haven't really seen since the Korean War. And that really changed the fabric of political discourse in Canada. Things like patriotism and nationalism, which used to be somewhat unfashionable in Canada, became very fashionable. We had the Olympics in Vancouver in 2010, which became this extremely jingoistic thing. I think Canada led the world in the number of gold medals we won. And Canada just became a very much more assertive country in terms of its national identity.
Are Canadian flags, are they more like of a thing?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah?
You know, the Wall Street Journal in Sochi, the Wall Street Journal reporter wrote this long article about how somewhat annoying the Canadian presence was there, and how many Canadian flags were there, and how you know, Canada was a country that you could count on it to apologize every time it won a medal, and that's changed. And so that's had a subtle effect on the politics. I also think the bad odor that Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin left after all their years in office, they left – there was a huge scandal. I won't bore you with the details. It was called the sponsorship scandal. That kind of discredited the Liberal Party for a few years. And also, Canada is a nation of immigrants. And many of the immigrants who come to Canada are admitted on economic criteria. Many are from South Asia and East Asia, extremely entrepreneurial-minded. That's why they came to Canada. And you have this huge urban ethnic entrepreneurial class that really has very little interest in lectures about social solidarity and social justice. And they're all about the conditions for making money, which is the reason they came to Canada in the first place. You know, we're a country that admits almost 1% of our population in immigration every year.
Wow.
The Harper government has played very well to that constituency on economic grounds. And for that reason, things like low taxes, disentangling some of the regulatory hurdles to business development. These have all been top of agenda for the conservatives, and they've done a very good job creating a coalition on that basis. Now, from a social point of view, it's still an extremely Scandinavian liberal country. Abortion on demand, gay marriage, which universal health care.
Harper is not pro-abortion, though, right? I mean, he's somewhat... Harper is a devout Christian, right? Or so I'm told.
He's a Christian who, as a politician, has shown absolutely no interest in any of the big social issues that regularly create a firestorm in the United States. No interest in gay marriage, abortion, bioethical issues in general. I think the only issue in that constellation of sort of gods, gays, and guns that interest him are the guns issue.
Really?
He's rolled back – yeah. Well, he's rolled back some of the extremely draconian anti-gun laws that Canada once had. That we had a notorious law called the Gun Registry. I won't bore you with the details, but he got rid of that.
I'm sort of interested just briefly. So is this more like rifles for hunting that people want? Or is it like handguns in urban areas? I mean, in the U.S., the Second Amendment is such a overriding thing that, even though gun rights supporters tend to be in more rural areas, or ex-urban areas tend to be into hunting and stuff, you know, the practical result is that the south side of Chicago is flooded with handguns and is a war zone. Is it more controlled, this sort of deregulation of guns in Canada? Or?
There's no equivalent to the Second Amendment in Canada.
Yeah.
As a result, gun control laws are extremely strict by American standards. It is possible under certain conditions to own a handgun, but handgun use and even ownership is heavily stigmatized in most parts of Canada, especially urban Canada. There are a lot of people in Canada who have hunting rifles that they use for things like pest control and hunting. Canada does have an active hunting culture. However, the law that I alluded to earlier, the gun registry, it made rifle ownership, shotgun and rifle ownership, difficult even for people who had these guns for a perfectly legitimate purpose. And it was one of the reasons that the conservatives got elected in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, to the extent there's a gun culture in Canada, it tends to be a rural gun culture based on ownership of long guns for issues that have to do with wholesome activities like hunting, farming, state defense, that sort of thing. It's very difficult to own a handgun in Canada. And most of the handguns that exist here in Toronto are illegal guns that come from the United States and are imported by gangs.
I see. Such as the one that Rob Ford seems to be socializing with, perhaps. But
it's exactly that sort of gang, yes.
So one other big thing that seems, in my outside observation, to be very relevant to the rise of Harper and Canadian conservatism is the energy industry, which I gather is centered in Alberta, which is his home province, right?
Yes, and it's been expanding like gangbusters, thanks in large part to the development of the oil sands,
right,
which is an unconventional source of oil. For decades, they thought that it couldn't be commercially exploited because the bitumen, which is contained therein, is a very thick, molasses-like petrochemical substance, very expensive to refine. But when the price of oil went up over $30, $40 a barrel, it became economic. And now Canada is, well, it's already one of the world's big oil producers, but it's poised to become, to go even higher on the list of world oil producers.
And so you've got this sort of Texas-like culture going on in Alberta now that, I gather that Harper is as closely tied to that as the Bush family is to Texas oil business. Is that fair?
No, I wouldn't say that's fair, because in the case of the Bush family, they actually had an equity stake, as I understand it, in various oil industries. I mean, George H.W. Bush, to my understanding, that was one of the pillars of his rise in oil business.
Man. Yeah,
yeah.
Harper
was never an oil executive. I mean, the thing about Harper is he was always a policy wonk. You see photos of him from high school and college. He was this dweeby guy organizing debates on things like provincial federal relations. So he was never a business guy. Now, as a politician, he obviously does have social relationships with people in the oil industry. And also from a regional and ideological point of view, he's extremely pro-oil. And he's made it his business since he became prime minister to do everything in his power to make sure that the oil industry doesn't have any legislative barriers en route to turning Alberta into, as you say, the Texas of the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of a fascinating thing for me because I always thought of, you know, Canada, along with all of its other kind of left of U.S. positions, to be, you know, pretty pro-environment. Now I walk around, you know, the Metro Center stop in downtown Washington, D.C., and every single ad in the Metro Center stop, the last time I was there a few months ago, is sponsored by the Canadian government, talking about how, you know, Canadian oil is clean and, you know, is supplying millions of Americans with power. And, you know, we should work with Canada because otherwise we'll work with evil petrostates like Saudi Arabia and promoting the Keystone Pipeline, obviously, which is an important part of this. And, you know, I also see these ads on the back of the New Republic magazine. I mean, it seems like there's been a huge blitz by Canada to promote itself the way that Gulf states or Kazakhstan or countries like that have promoted themselves. It's, you know, these very glossy ads as a safe, reliable partner for the energy industry. Is this reflected in Canada's domestic image of itself?
Domestically, Canadians still think of themselves as environmentalists, which mm-hmm. is a total joke because in terms of the amount of carbon we burn per capita, we're one of the world's leading nations. I mean, that's in part because we're so big, you know, so we end up taking a lot of, you know, long car rides and long, we have big houses and we fly, you know, you fly to Vancouver, it's, you know, it's a 5-hour flight.
Right.
So we're a big country. We burn a lot of fossil fuels. And yet we like to think of ourselves as the land of snow and seals and sunshine. So we lie to ourselves about being environmentalists. In terms of our public image in the United States, you know, those ads you were talking about in Washington, there is a grain of truth to that. You know, who would you rather buy your oil from? Canada, which is, you know, it's just whatever else you could say about it, it's a stable democracy. Or Venezuela, which, you know, is one coup away from being completely dysfunctional. Or Saudi Arabia, where, you know, which has its own geopolitical problems. You know, that is – everything that's in those ads is true. But from a cultural point of view, yes, it is a little weird for a country that has so long branded itself as a pristine homeland for environmentalists, and now our branding is basically come buy our oil to mm-hmm. heat your homes and drive your cars.
Tell us a little about the Liberal parties. I think there are multiple of them in Canada. And why? When was the last Canadian national election? Actually, when did the Conservatives retain power last?
The Conservatives won. They first came to power under Harper in 2006. Then again in 2008. Mm-hmm. And then in 2011 was a big one because they won power for a third time. But this time they won a majority government. And that's a term that doesn't necessarily translate to U.S. politics because we have a parliamentary system,
right.
So you have a minority. So majority government, it's equivalent of one party having the presidency and also having more than 60 senators, having, you know, sort of filibuster-proof majority in the Senate,
right.
And also having the House of Representatives. So that's in rough Republican terms, that's essentially what Harper has had since 2011. The result of that threw the Liberal Party, which is roughly analogous to the Democrats in the United States, threw it into complete disarray. Before that, going into that election, they had a celebrity leader by the name of Michael Ignatieff,
yes.
who had a very successful run as an internationally celebrated intellectual at Harvard. And he ended up being a complete dud as a politician, which sometimes happens. I mean, it's, you know, Ignatieff's a nice guy, but not everybody's cut out for politics. And as a result, Liberal Party, you know, some doubted whether it would even continue existing because
wow.
it was had been and so badly. Yeah, I mean, it was a really rough moment for the Liberals. And now their new leader is a guy by the name of Justin Trudeau. He's younger than I am. I think he's 42 or something like that. He is the first son of former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. He's also very telegenic and charismatic. He has nice hair, you know. So a lot of his critics have tried to stereotype him as just being kind of a flash in the pan. On the other hand, polls have suggested that he's an extremely viable political leader, and the next election should be very competitive.
Are Canadians happy with Harper? And actually, related question. So they want a majority. I don't know how accurately representative the Canadian political system is. In the U.S., there are all kinds of distortions brought about by the Senate, by gerrymandering, by the Electoral College. When he was elected with a majority, or when the Conservative Party was elected with a majority, does that actually reflect majority conservative sentiment in Canada, or is there some weird...
No, because we have in the United States, you have the Republicans and Democrats, and then, you know, a few oddball parties that usually have trouble getting on the ballot.
Right.
In Canada, you have ridings in Canada that are contested five ways.
Riding is like a congressional district.
It's the rough equivalent of a congressional district, and you might have the Conservatives, you might have the Liberals, you might have the New Democratic Party, the NDP, which is sort of like, think of Denis Kucinich if he had his own political party. You have the Greens, which, you know, an environmental party. And in Quebec, you've had the Bloc Québécois, which is a separatist regional party. So, as I say, you have ridings where you could have five parties splitting the vote. As a result of that, you often will have ridings where the plurality vote, the candidate that gets elected, might only have 30 or 35% of the vote. Nationally, the Stephen Harper's Tories have been at something like 35, 37, close to 40% of the vote in terms of the elections they've won. So you can win an election in Canada getting only about a third of the vote.
Yeah. So is Harper popular now?
He's become less popular because he's governed Canada competently, but he's also a vengeful, increasingly bitter fellow who's started to pick a lot of bad political fights. Like every party, it's had its scandals after many years in power. He's never been the most charismatic guy, and as the years march on, some of his more angry, negative personal attributes have really come to the fore. And the state of the country is good. His popularity is, I wouldn't say it's extremely low, but it's gotten lower over the last couple of years.
Okay.
And that's the opportunity that Justin Trudeau has, because Justin Trudeau is the Liberal leader, tends to have, you know, very upbeat message. People like him, much better brand association in the minds of most voters.
All right. So one last thing, you mentioned Quebec earlier and their separatist party. I actually, last summer, right before I moved here, my girlfriend and I, we took a trip to Montreal. Not my first. It's a wonderful city. I love Montreal.
My hometown.
Lucky you. It's such a terrific place to visit. Well, certainly in the summer anyway. But
it's beautiful.
And we had a great time there. And one thing I noticed as I was walking around there, and wasn't entirely surprised by, is that, you know, we also mentioned the Canadian flag earlier, and I would say for every Canadian flag I saw in Montreal, I probably saw two or three Quebecois provincial flags with the fleur-de-lis. And this, I assume, is reflective of Quebec's status as a sort of nation within a nation with strong separatist tendencies, which I gather are actually probably least strong in Montreal relative to the rest of the province. And I understand there's been some recent drama with that. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. The incumbent government provincial government going to the recent election, I guess last month, was a separatist government. It was the Parti Québécois led by Premier Pauline Marois. And their goal since the creation of the party in the 60s, their goal has been to create a separate country called Quebec. And they've won elections, they've lost elections. And going into this particular election, they were extremely confident because they had just introduced this populist piece of legislation known as the Charter of Secular Values, which many people decried as being anti-Jewish, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant. But it was a popular bit of political posturing that allowed the Parti Québécois to present itself as a guardian of Québécois values.
Secular, you said. That's very interesting. That's a French concept, right? Laïcité, like the idea that secularism is the state religion and it's sort of wielded against religious minorities, like with the veil and stuff.
In the current context, it was very much borrowed from the political scene in Europe, where you have socially conservative parties in places like the Netherlands and in Scandinavia presenting themselves as guardians of national identity by being anti-religious, specifically by being anti-Muslim.
Right.
And so in that context, the Parti Québécois presented itself as upholding secularism in response to this exaggerated threat presented by immigrants. Anyway, the whole thing was very much exaggerated and unpleasant, but Pauline Marois thought she was going to ride it to victory in this latest election. What happened was very much the opposite. The Parti Québécois received a stunning rebuke at the polls. I think they got something like 25% of the vote, historically a low number. And as a result of that, the result is interpreted as of Quebec voters not only rejecting this sort of xenophobic piece of legislation that the PQ wanted to present, but also rejecting separatism itself.
Huh.
And so now you have the new Quebec premier, a guy by the name of Philippe Couillard, former brain surgeon, very broad-minded in his outlook, intellectual guy, and it's a very positive moment in Quebec politics because, as I say, voters have rejected separatism and they've rejected this very small-minded, parochial attitude toward immigrants that was being peddled by the Parti Québécois. As a native Quebecer, as someone born and raised in Montreal, lived the first 25 years of my life there, I was actually thrilled with the election results. Under Pauline Marois and the PQ, Quebec was becoming a place that I didn't recognize politically, very small-minded, angry, bitter place. And her defeat at the polls was welcomed not only by many Quebecers, well, three-quarters of Quebecers apparently, but also by people all across Canada who were just disgusted by what she was doing to that province.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in Montreal, one thing I was really struck by is that although it is a primarily French-speaking city and there were all these flags and there's obviously a strong sense of provincial identity, it's also a much more diverse city than I think it's often given credit for. Everyone knows it's, you know, Francophone with this Anglophone minority, but it's also, I mean, there's Italians and Portuguese and a huge Jewish community and a Chinatown. And it's also very, I mean, there's a huge gay community and there's a large area that felt a lot like, you know, kind of hipster Brooklyn. And just going through all these places, I mean, it's not quite as superlatively diverse as Toronto is, but it's still seemed like a very cosmopolitan place where these kind of, and the Québécois couple that we were staying with, we were talking to them about, and they were very opposed to this sort of xenophobic separatism, but they were saying, you know, Montreal is one thing, and then the rest of the province is kind of another story. Of course, Montreal is probably close to half the province's population or something. I don't know, but
yeah, I mean that's probably true. I think Montreal is a wonderful city. It's exactly as you described it. It's very multicultural. People get along. Most people in Montreal, I think, well, a lot of them anyway, were sort of confused by why you needed a new piece of legislation to govern relationships between different immigrant groups, because in Montreal, people get along quite well. It is broadly true that most immigrants settle in Montreal, and most Anglophones in the province live in Montreal.
Yeah.
So as a result, you go outside of Montreal, and great swaths of the province are basically all white, all French, all either Catholic or lapsed Catholic. You know, very few immigrants outside of Montreal. And it does create two societies. You know, in the American context, I vacation in southern Maine. And so, you know, compare, you know, southeastern Maine near Boston, where, you know, all these urban types, including a lot of Canadians, go on vacation and it's beautiful. And, you know, it's, you say, oh, you know, this is very sophisticated and urban and multicultural. But then, you know, you go 20 miles inland and things are very different. And the economy is based on logging and hunting and stuff like that. And the demographics are much the way they were 100 years ago. There are plenty of parts of the United States that are like that, and there are plenty of parts of Canada like that. Immigrants tend to go to cities.
Yeah.
And as a result, in many Western societies, including Canada and including the United States, you have extremely different socioeconomic clusters and different ethnic clusters living in cities than you do, you know, just a half hour's drive away in the country.
Yeah. One, we went to some old, like, lunch counter in Mile End, and we got egg cream, and we were talking, maybe you know what it was. It's near the bagel places, but it's not them. But we were talking to the kind of middle-aged Jewish proprietor of the place, and she was saying, and I'd heard this before, that when sort of back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, when there was this rise of Quebec nationalism, Montreal had been the Jewish center of Canada, and it's still probably the second Jewish center of Canada, but there was this huge exodus of Jews to Toronto because, you know, Jews, we like our multicultural cosmopolitan cities. We're sort of uncomfortable with anything else. Is that an accurate history? Do you have any personal connections to that history? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I'm one of those Jews you just mentioned. In my case, I left for, you know, because I didn't think my French was good enough to build a professional life in Montreal. But certainly a lot of my friends and colleagues and some of my relatives have made the same exodus. They left Quebec because they were a little bit uncomfortable with the political situation. A lot of this happened in the mid-70s when the Parti Québécois first came to power. And it's sort of continued since then. But there still is a strong and vibrant Anglophone and Jewish community there.
Yeah.
But Toronto, in many ways, has superseded Montreal. Montreal, you know, you go back 50, 60 years, it very much competed with Toronto as the sort of cultural and economic center of Canada. And that's changed. Now Toronto is the unquestioned capital, but culturally, economically, demographically. It's the number one destination for immigrants. But, you know, for anyone listening to this who's thinking of a summer vacation, Montreal is a fantastic destination. Food's great. And yes. It has a great new provincial government that that I'm very happy won the one April election.
Great. Well, we should probably wrap up. But any last random Canadian stories that you think an American audience should know about?
Random Canadian stories. Well, I guess I'm sorry about what happened to the Raptors. As we speak, two days ago, they got beaten by 1 point in Game 7 against the Brooklyn Nets. That was extremely unfortunate.
Yeah, and the Brooklyn Nets, one fan was very excited about that.
And right now, the hopes of a nation rest on the Montreal Canadiens, who are 1-1 in their series with the Boston Bruins. That's actually one of the most ferocious rivalries in all of professional sports. So if you talk to any Canadian over the next week or two, the first thing you should ask them is how the Montreal Canadiens are doing. That's right. It's probably a more important story emotionally for most of us than Rob Ford at the moment.
I bet even Rob Ford would agree with that. But
wherever you are, Rob, you know, if tell us where you are and tell the National Post, we can get the scoop on. Because as I say, he's in hiding. So the most famous Canadian right now, internationally famous Canadian, is in hiding. If anybody knows where he is, tweet me, the National Post, so I can get the scoop.
That's at John Kay, right?
At John Kay, yeah. That's right.
Well, John, thanks so much. This has been fun and informative. And I know Canadian politics has a stereotype of being boring, but I actually think there's a lot of great stories there. So,
well, thank you for being such an informed interviewer. Most people who interview me about Canadian politics ask about igloos and polar bears. So I appreciate the intelligent questions.
Well, maybe that can be our next conversation.
Okay.
I'll talk to you soon, John.
Take care. Bye.